All right, so very special day for me. I'm very excited. We have two of the biggest brains in Microsoft here. This is the pinnacle of my career. Jeff Hahn, Bill Buxton, both at the same time. This is going to be an amazing interview. And I didn't realize at the time when I invited you both that you are friends. And
is that right? You didn't realize that?
I did not know that.
I didn't realize that.
So,
wow.
And what were you guys doing last night?
Oh, he was over at my place. We were just actually going over old videos of stuff.
Old Channel 9 videos?
Well, this is actually couples into how we know each other, actually. Well, maybe not, but there is a funny story to tell here, and I'm a little embarrassed to tell, but I might as well. When I was really young.
Seven,
way before I was getting into user interface or user interaction work. I was actually more of a computer graphics person before that, and actually I was pretty much the consummate like double E growing up. I mean, I started soldering when I was six. I have a scar still on my foot from those days. You know, Asian household, barefoot. You know, sister trips over the cord and just hits my foot. Anyway. We didn't have a computer growing up. I was much more into electronics, but there was a PBS show that my dad told me we did get a VCR pretty early on, and he would look out for content to kind of capture, particularly educational stuff. And so he saw this show that was, I think, in the newspaper to say it's a show that we should record. It's, I think, 12 episodes, and it was a half an hour every week, and it was my duty to make sure I recorded that show. And it turns out to be a show that was a really great show. It's called Bits and Bytes. It was really well put together in 1982. And every episode was 12 episodes, each one about, and you have to remember in 82, computers were still very kind of like a really almost scary thing for a lot of people. They don't understand. So this show was really about, and did a great job of trying to introduce to the general layperson what a computer is. And they actually did a really good job of doing everything from you don't have to be afraid to turn it on, what is RAM versus ROM, what is a modem, what is a file system, and it actually did a great job. And then as the series progressed toward the later end of its run, they started focusing on things like graphics and things on sound, and they had some great, they had great footage of stuff from, you know, research level stuff that really was just super exciting to see. Really cutting edge work in graphics and computer music. And the last episode was something called What Next? It was basically the open-ended future episode where they introduced internet, video discs, and actually things like Smalltalk and actually more advanced interfaces like touch. So anyway, so I had all those captured, and there was so little content in the library and about computers that I just kept watching tapes over and over when I was little. Anyway, fast forward, I transitioned out of computer graphics to start working on some of this multi-touch stuff. And in during that research, of course, I really like to do my homework and read. I'm a really quite an infovore and read everything that's been done in the field thus far. So, of course, I became quite familiar with Bill's work. And also, just incidentally, ran into him at SIGGRAPH or SIGCHI or WIST, and we just developed a good rapport. Then there was some random, there was a weird epiphany that came up where I realized, wait a minute, I think have I seen you before? And I mean, this was after I actually met you, that I came, that I had this weird recollection that, wait a minute, could that video be the same? So I went back to my parents' house, went down into storage. This VHS tape was covered in mold and dust, and I had it all cleaned off and restored and captured. And sure enough, that last episode where they go into touch and multi-touch and other really really interesting work from 82 was actually Bill.
Wow.
In really great, some really great footage of him at University of Toronto wearing an ascot.
That was very cool.
Great fashion of the day. Yeah. And it turns out, yeah, oh my God, that it's him. And this, you can almost relate this as how my getting into this field was almost embedded that early on from those days of being really inspired by, and I actually do believe this is true, you can actually have your direction set when you get inspired by such things really early on.
Oh, yeah,
and subconsciously steer yourself toward those things. I mean, I'm going to send you the video so you can actually maybe edit that in, but it's just really...
And what was your first computer that you used?
So the first computer I used, that's a funny question.
What was the first computer you owned?
First computer I owned, we didn't have much money growing up, so it was an Apple II GS, actually. And but before then, for instance, the middle school I went to actually had some really great access to early things. So I, for instance, learned assembly in a PDP-11. Mm-hmm. Played around with obviously PCs and TIs and other things of that era. But the first one where I actually completely got to own was an Apple II GS. And the funny thing is, I also remember at the time, it was really funny. I actually chose that computer amongst the other kind of like an Amiga or something else in a day because for actually very petty reasons. It wasn't the most powerful computer. It wasn't even the most graphically rich computer. But I couldn't stand the typeface that these other computers use on their keyboard, or the default character generator that's on the Amiga. It's actually really hideous, and it's disproportioned. That's another aspect I've come to realize that I've made decisions about which environment I like to work in based on things like that kind of design, just experience around it, and of course. I mean, that was the glory days of Frog Design and Eslinger and the whole Snow White design language. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I actually picked that Apple II GS. That was just more gorgeous a device to work with, all the way down to the typeface and what they used on the keyboard.
As a graphics person, I would have thought you'd orient around an Amiga.
Yeah, exactly. But when you're actually coding or actually interacting with it, I literally couldn't stand the typeface that I had to work with.
So we can, there's a nice story there that repeats itself over and over even today. And just change the actors and change the words, but it's the same story. And I worked on the Amiga before it was released. And by the way, the greatest product launch ever. Microsoft has still something to learn from that. We had Andy Warhol and Debbie Harry, who was a singer from Blondie, managing that. And then Michael Bodiger, Tom Scott, Roger, I'm blanking, great keyboard player. I'm just having a senior's moment, but at the Lincoln Center. But coming back to this, so when I saw the Amiga, I said, the fonts suck. You've got to fix that.
That's hilarious. And
so I was pushing really hard, but I was there to work on the audio and some of the interaction stuff. Now, there was a guy in the day in Silicon Valley called Scott Kim, who really understood anti-alias fonts and stuff like that. And he does a really nice job, and I think he was the one responsible for a lot of stuff in the Apple. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to get them to meet Scott, and there's some stuff that happened at the Architecture Machine Group about anti-alias fonts too, before the Media Lab. And so I said, look, all we have to do is make these anti-alias fonts, and or put a decent monitor on, don't just use the TV set. People aren't gonna buy this in TV set. And mm-hmm. said, no, it's not worth it. We don't need to, this is just fine. And nobody ever buys a personal computer with a monitor. And therefore, we're going to make it just for TV, interlaced NTSC, and we're not going to anti-alias the fonts. So I lost out on everything. So, and of course, the geniuses who made that decision were the people who sold the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64, where of course they just plugged it into a TV. But they didn't realize, and it turned out, that well over 95% of the people who bought an Amiga actually bought the monitor. So they didn't have to make those compromises anyhow, but they did. Now, the good news about that is that that meant it still worked with video, and so it had this future in video, but it had no future at all in the serious thing for word processing or text, because the fonts just were totally unacceptable, especially for that particular time. And there's a case where they designed it for what used to be as opposed to what was coming. And because they had experience in the past and they had no experience in the future, so they just relied the data from where we're coming from instead of where we're going. And the biggest challenge is how do you, when you're designing and trying to innovate, do you say, I don't care how much your data research and the numbers from the previous sales that are, mm-hmm. are we going into the past or are we going into the future? And sometimes the past can really inform the future, and sometimes it's a negative. Don't do that. We don't need to do that anymore. Change. Be aware of why we're doing it and so on. But that, I think, the issues about the fonts for word processing and stuff that were completely avoidable.
Yeah.
But the people who were the gatekeepers, the senior people, got there because of successes in the past problems, and that doesn't necessarily qualify them for the future problems.
Well, the funny thing, the Amiga was, they actually anticipated and they were forward-looking in a lot of ways. Yeah. Everything you said might be true. I actually just think that they just, the wrong person with no design sense was actually picking some of these mundane things. Like even the cursor. I mean, this had nothing to do with skating to where the puck is. That cursor was just so ugly.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to point it at anything. And the default color scheme for the text editor was like blue and orange, I think. It has to be something even less than that.
But there was no designer.
Yeah.
For me, it was amazing. My first computer was a Timex Sinclair. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I got to the Amiga, I was sold. I knew that I wanted to be in computers.
That's
because
right.
it was entirely new. And it focused around audio and video, which at the time wasn't, you know, something you could do with your typical computers.
Well, that was what got me into computers, too. I mean, and that's why it's really easy, if you understand that, to see why I got into, user interaction. Because I only got into computers because of computer graphics. In other words, or sensors, the I.O. problem. As I said, I was really into electronics, and you're really into electronics to actually twiddle LEDs and twiddle and capture from sensors. And back at the time, right when I was getting our first computer, I was also building a Z80 computer from scratch. That was the kind of thing you did as a double E growing up.
Yeah.
And then when I realized, and one of the greatest things about the Apple II is it had that game port on there that had the joystick and all the digital converters, but also a few bits of twiddle. And then when you first realize you can program that, it's so much easier than building all the other stuff, and you can focus on that, and then you can start drawing lines, and that really just it really wicked my attention over to like, okay, I don't need to build this stuff. I'm going to just focus on the graphics, and so that's what carried me all the way through. I couldn't let go of the hardware, so I've really done both for as much as I could along the way, both formal education and everything. But I only got into this stuff because of the input output, that kind of sensory experience.
So there's a really important thing that fits in this, and it's really timely and top relevant to right now. I have had very similar. My first computer was made for me. It was a tailor-made thing in 19. I used it in 1971, and it could already do interactive animation and interactive music. I did my first film soundtrack on that 100% digitally in 1971, and it was a system where I could be introduced into it for a two-hour introduction, and then they would leave me overnight by myself, and I could work productively on this thing. It had color graphics. It had two-handed input. It had a piano keyboard we could play. It would come up in common music notation. Had a half-inch MPEX tape recorder, four-track that I could laid down the digital stuff off the D2A converters for software synthesis onto that and control all that, all with computer graphics, interaction, cording, keyboard. It was just spectacular. Okay, that's my first time I saw a computer. But it was a little bit later that I got, a fair bit later when I got my own first personal computer. And likewise, I couldn't afford to buy a computer. So I went down and bought the board, got the clone kit, and soldered together my own Apple II. And so similar story. But I also started to make devices. Now, the really critical thing was that at that point, up until about 84, when the Mac first came out, and then we went a little bit further, if you were going to do interesting stuff, interactive computing wasn't about software and it wasn't about hardware. You had to do both. Mm-hmm. And it was impossible to separate the two. You had an idea, and then you sort of say, okay, so how do I integrate the hardware and software, build things from the mechanical part of things, the electronics, the circuits, you learn how to wire wrap, you learn how to solder, you learn how to do all these things. And it's actually really fun because when it's peaceful, it's the sort of a Zen kind of quality. But the main thing was we all had that competence. The people who were, I think, really made a difference in graphics and computer science. The same thing, Billy Reeves and Tom Duff and Rob Pike, all these people who were sort of heroes in computer graphics world, they were designing and building display processors and putting this stuff up and integrating them into Unix and then hacking the kernel on a PDP 1145. Yeah. We were all doing that.
Yeah.
And then using double port memory so I could actually get real time on it, even though it's a time sharing Unix system with graphics. I had an LSI 11 that I could drive straight into there and then manage the real time stuff of my synthesizer so I could actually do music on all this stuff. It was a great, great time. When we came out and the graphic user interface got established, let's say 84 to 86, and the PC came out, interaction design and HCI became a software thing. All the mouse, keyboard, CRT were a given. And what you were doing is just trying to make the menus better and make it easier to navigate and stuff like that, and we lost the hardware craft. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I love about what's happening right now is that as we move, as ubiquitous computing starts to come into the place, and it's just partially because the cost of getting into doing interesting parts because of 3D printing and so on. 3D printing has been around for years and years and years, right? That was called milling machines and later stereolithography and so on and so forth. But the cost has changed by orders of magnitude, which makes it possible. Just as the cost of computers made personal computers mm-hmm. become possible. It's the same type of thing, personal manufacturing. So people are building circuits, and you have people coming out of design schools like Eindhoven and so on that can do digital logic. They can solder, they can program, they can do 3D modeling, they can set that up with a 3D printer, put the stuff together. And we're getting into a world right now where if you can see the seam between hardware and software, it's probably a failure of design. And if you're aware of that there's even a computer there, in many cases, it's a failure of design. We're building these things that integrate, and then just start, and that making part, I think, maybe isn't the panacea that has been overhyped, and 3D printers are maybe a little bit overhyped, but the fact is that people are now starting to come out and have the sense of a sensibility in design, a sensibility in hardware and software. And I think in some sense that's Jeff's strength. He epitomizes that.
Yeah.
And that's the pragmatic level. And that means that, and the people that in interaction design that I see are the best, and I learned this, the person who first articulated this to me was a guy named Brian Shackle, who taught at Loughborough and was the father of HCI in Europe, certainly in Great Britain. And I asked him this question, what of your students, because he's older at the time, well, almost as old as me, so it was a while ago, but anyhow, he said the students, they'd grown up playing with Lego, mechano sets, soldering, and so on and so forth, and chemistry sets, so fixing cars, bicycles, sewing, pottery, whatever, but they had a strong sense of materials and making. But they also, and there are lots of people who can do that, that's not sufficient. It's essential, but not sufficient. And the other was, they had the ability, when they looked at a problem, to step up and go meta. Mm-hmm. And be able to get the right abstraction, see relationships. And then they were able to work outside in, as opposed to top down or bottom up. It was, I'm aware of all this technologies are out there. That's my repertoire of colors, or my palette of colors, my repertoire of tricks. And here's my sense of the problem. I can generalize and see that things scale enough of that. And then how do I find, in the most pragmatic way possible, how to squeeze it down? Because I can be completely compromised on the technology if I understand that it's not the hardware, software, it's the wetware. It's the human that's the most important technology, and that. And you had this great line you're just from Hill that I hadn't seen before earlier today.
Yeah, Bill Hill. So Channel 9 video.
Yeah, paraphrase that, because I just heard it for the first time today. But he's saying exactly the same thing, but way more eloquently.
He was saying, I'm paraphrasing here, but you know, the most popular operating system, the most important operating system in the world, isn't Windows version 95 or 2000, or isn't Mac OS or OS X or iOS and everything. It's Homo sapiens version 1.0.
Yeah.
It's been shipping for 100,000 years. There's no upgrade in sight.
Yeah.
And we gotta be developing for that,
yeah.
Right? That's the most important operating system. That's the only one of relevance, really. Everything else is.
And that's the neat thing. So when people are saying the technology, all these things are changing like crazy underneath you, that I've always said that. Well, I just study the human because it's not changing that much. So I'm always current. And it also means that's my priorities are straight. So I'm always happy to dump the last technology and bring in the new one and use whatever's appropriate. It's about what's appropriate for the time. Do the appropriate triage and away you go. But if you get married in the technology, it's so easy to get sucked in. Mm-hmm. And it's being willing to say, I love you dearly, but it's time to go, baby.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I loved about learning about and discovering Bill the way I did in that story before was that the lab and the work that I got so enamored with when I was young was actually out of driven by the fact that you're a musician and you're trying to just build better interfaces for you to actually literally express yourself through music. And this multi-touch device he was developing was purely towards that, and better interface, and the entire research group was driven with a kind of initial computer music a drive, but of course acknowledging that it's useful for you know, 100 other things. It makes so much sense, because I mean, what the purpose of an instrument is to try to capture as much expressivity out of the user and really be in tune with what a human can do and express in all sorts of mechanisms, not just with digits, but with, you know, with breath and with every other part of him. That's why it's so interesting to see all every type of instrument out there. And
I've the other thing it pushes too is low latency, because a musician needs to have that.
So I always thought I was just going to be a musician, and I was just making instruments because it was easier to learn how to build my own than buy what was available. Because
or try to tell somebody how.
Or that, right? And that's what I was doing. I was going to go back and do music. And somewhere around 1978, Alan Kay came up from Park and visited Ron Becker, who was one of my mentors. They were good buddies, and Alan came in and he saw what I was doing, and he just went, "Wow, this is really cool." I said, "Yeah, because he was a musician and he liked that." But he said, "You're not doing music." And I said, "What do you mean? Of course I'm doing music. Let me play some music." He said, "No, what you're doing is way more than that." And I had no idea. He said, "This is really important stuff." And so he invited me down to Park. And actually, within 2 weeks, he sent two people from his team at Park to spend a week or two with me and our team. And that developed a really long-standing relationship. But I think the thing is here, and this touches on something I think is really important. I've always been a physical person, and my body, the body language and things like that is, I like tools, and I've always wondered, is that just because I'm, is that relevant? And I think, or is it just interesting, or to me at least? But, and it's this, I believe that musicians have a longer history of expressing powerful creative ideas through a technological intermediary than any other profession in the world. The only thing to compete might be weapons, but I'd argue that's not necessarily intelligent, right?
Yeah.
Or creative, in the sense that I want to think about it. But I'll put it to you in this way. What music as a wind player taught me is phrasing. The notion of breath, same thing, you had to take singing. And the notion of a gesture and a stroke. We always have this notion of a musical gesture. And you notice there's this body language that came with music. Like if I'm listening to Baroque music, I'm doing this. If I'm listening to heavy metal, there's a whole other body language. And I realized, there is no body language or natural body language for music. It depends on what the music is, and it depends on the context, and so on and so forth. And you start to see those relationships. It's called idiomatic, is the musical term. And then you start saying, that's true for everything. And then there's this whole notion about phrasing. And then all my work on gesture started. Somebody sort of said, "Bill, your work has no coherence. You're not a scientist. You're just ad hoc." And I knew somehow there was something consistent about everything I was doing, but I'd never expressed the glue. And so I love people telling me that I just understand what I'm doing or this is stupid, because it challenged me to sort of say, if I disagree and I don't have an answer, instead of being offended or whatever, that says, "Wow, that's really interesting. I don't have an answer about something that's fundamental to what I'm doing. Maybe I should think about it." And those people who challenge me like that are my favorite kind of people. People like Jeff, he calls me on stuff all the time. Everybody I work with do. You never lose face in that way. I'd far rather be wrong and then learn than pretend I'm right and it because I'm afraid of risk in losing face. But the main thing is that all the gesture stuff says that I'm in neutral position right now. When I start to articulate something, it's not just pushing a button or that. It's the whole phrase, the sentence of the transaction. So the minute I start to move, I'm in a non-neutral state, and I start to have pressure. And the things are connected, and it's not I'm not interruptible while I'm in the middle. It's like I'm speaking right now. You can't interrupt me. And if I keep talking, if I can just cycle breathe like I could do on a saxophone, you can never interrupt me, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that when I'm finished and back neutral, it signals I'm done. I can answer the phone. Space for you to come in and question, but those are all fundamentally musical gestures, but they actually are the fundamentals of body language and our gestural vocabulary. If there's anything natural in we're talking about this gestural stuff, it's that. That's the essence of it. It's phrasing, and that this notion of tension, relaxation, whether it's breath or movement or muscular tension, those are the delimiters that shape the phrase. That's the punctuation instead of a capital letter and a period with the half stops with a comma and semicolon of the body language. And so it's probably not a coincidence that people like Alan or a lot of people who've worked in the space come out of maybe dance or come out out of music. And I'd say that right now, the skill, because I think it's so much about the transitions, that the missing skill set in our field that needs way more population are people who understand how to design these transitions.
Right.
And so the skills that you aren't necessarily even cinematic, but actually maybe from the video game, some of what those art directors and creative talents know. We don't have enough of that. It's not about the storyboards. It's about the arrows that connect the storyboards. Right.